From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For nearly 50 years, physicists had guessed, had theorized there was a particle that would basically explain what it is that's holding everything in the universe together. To find the particle, they built this massive collider, and they were trying to shake out a particle. Last July, scientists at the collider announced they had found the particle. In March, they confirmed it. There are only a few people on the planet who can explain this Higgs boson particle and why it matters, and one of them is Brian Greene. Today in the program, he's joining us. It's daunting, a discussion like this. It's complicated, a little abstract, but it's also one of the biggest scientific discoveries ever made. So we're talking about it today, and we hope you'll stick with us as we do. Brian Greene today, after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It had been a theory for nearly 50 years, this idea that there was a particle that could confirm this idea about the basic structure of matter. It's crucial to our understanding of the universe. To find this particle, scientists built a massive collider, a machine that's 18 miles long almost. It smashes protons together with astounding speed and energy. The idea was to shake out the particle. And so they tried and tried and tried, something like 300 trillion of these collisions, something like that. Last July, scientists at the collider announced they had found the particle, they thought, anyway. In March, they confirmed it. They had found the Higgs boson particle. Now, they're still not sure what kind of Higgs particle this is exactly, but it's a big deal. And there are only really a few people in the world who can help explain how this works, what it means, and why the rest of us should care about how big a deal it is. That person is the physicist Brian Greene, and today in the program, he's joining us. We hope you'll join us as well if you have comments or questions. 801-585-WEST is the number, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'd also like to hear from those of you on Facebook and on Twitter. Brian Greene is a professor of physics and mathematics at Columbia University, the author of four books about the inner workings of the universe. They include his most recent book, The Hidden Reality. He's also the co-founder of the World Science Festival, which is going to be held later this spring in New York City. Brian Greene is joining us today from the studios of the Radio Foundation in New York City. And Dr. Greene, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Well, I guess I wanted to start with your reaction, because you talked about in July, or you've written about the fact in July you described it as your first physics-generated chill in a decade. So you had this big chill in July. Then how did you react in March? Talk about how you reacted.
Well, basically, just kept the chill going. The news in March was confirming what seemed pretty clear in July, which is, as you described, these fantastically powerful collisions taking place at the Large Hadron Collider had conjured up this particle that our mathematics had suggested should be there, mathematics that had been in place for 40, 45 years. And finally, for that math to be realized in the real world is a just spectacular feeling.
So have we moved from the theoretical to reality? Is this, or are we still kind of in the realm of conjecture like we always must be in some ways?
Well, I think that is the point. In science, you really never know something is true with 100% certainty. You just have ever greater confidence that it's true based upon ever more refined data and analysis. So everything that's happened over the course of the last year has had the same trajectory, all pointing toward this Higgs particle being real.
Yeah. So let's back up. I want to start with some basics because you've talked about this and I wanted you to sort of work us through some of this. Because really the question that seems to be at the heart of all of this is this question. Where does the mass of these elementary particles in the universe, you know, electrons and quarks, where does the mass of these particles come from? That's really the basic question to get us started.
That is the key question. People have struggled with that for a long time. And I mean, it sounds like such a very basic question. Maybe it's even one of those things that you don't even consider a question at all. It just seems so apparent.
Yeah.
The world is made up of objects that have mass. I mean, what is mass? It's the resistance that an object offers to having its speed change. Now, you push on a very heavy car and you try to make it go faster and you feel it resisting. And that's the mass of the car acting itself out on your hand. And the basic question is the one that you have described. When it comes to the fundamental particles, the constituents that make up everything, where does their mass come from? Why do they have any mass at all?
Yeah. So we needed to be able to get at that question, we needed some kind of mechanism, which brings us to Peter Higgs. This is the 1960s.
Yes.
And Higgs comes up with this, I guess it was a really out there idea, that there's this invisible substance or force out there that is holding everything in the universe together.
Right? Yeah, it sounds pretty nutty. And that really was the reaction of the community. You know, Peter Higgs and some others as well around the same time, I should say, had the idea that the origin of mass might be the environment. That is, space itself, according to these ideas, might be filled with an invisible substance, a kind of molasses-like substance, not a bad way of thinking about it. Mm-hmm. And much like a pebble going through molasses feels resistance as it tries to push through the thick molasses, maybe the fundamental particles like electrons and quarks, they feel a resistance as they try to move through this, let's call it a Higgs-like molasses that's surrounding all of us. And when Higgs wrote up the mathematical version of this story in a paper and sent it off to the journal, it was rejected. It was sent back as, you know, this is just nonsense.
Why do you figure there was such a reaction to it? Because it seemed too bizarre? I mean, why the reaction, do you figure, at first?
It is a good question. I mean, physicists are accustomed to bizarre ideas. I mean, quantum mechanics itself, which was developed in the early part of the 20th century, has, again, a whole range of crazy-sounding ideas, but nevertheless, they're borne out by experiment. And I guess in this particular case with Peter Higgs and others, the idea felt overwrought. It felt like requiring too much invisible machinery within the workings of the universe, and there had to be a simpler explanation, something that didn't require you to believe in all this other stuff that we don't see. And that wasn't a ridiculous reaction, but as people allowed Peter Higgs and others to explain the idea more fully, investigate the mathematics of it, people slowly began to realize, hey, this idea isn't as complex or as weird as it sounded at first. And slowly the community of physicists began to say, maybe this is right. Mm-hmm. And I should say, the funny thing is, for me, I wasn't around in those days. But when I was a graduate student back in the mid-1980s, and I took a course in particle physics, they taught us the Higgs mechanism, this idea of space being filled with this molasses-like substance. And it was taught in such a way that I thought it was confirmed. I thought it was true. I thought it was real, because there wasn't even a sense by the 1980s that this couldn't be correct, even though there as yet was not any data supporting it.
Mm.
I should say supporting it directly.
Directly, right. So I guess the idea is that in order for us – because it's invisible, this Higgs field, you need to – I think this is how you've put it, or at least how I understand it. You need to kind of jiggle it to shake out a particle that says it's there. Is that right?
Yeah, that's not a bad way of saying it. You know, if you imagine that we are embedded, immersed in this – Higgs-like ocean, maybe another metaphor,
Yeah. Maybe
too many metaphors here. But if you want to see a little piece of it, what do you do? Well, if you slam these particles together in Geneva, Switzerland, the hope is that through their collisions, they do kind of jiggle the environment, they jiggle the ocean, they jiggle the molasses, however you want to think about it. And through that jiggling, a little speck of the molasses can be flicked off. And that little speck would be a little particle. That would be the Higgs particle, the Higgs boson. So what they have been doing at the Large Hadron Collider in Geneva is doing just that. Slam these protons together near the speed of light, fantastically energetic collisions. Mm. And through those collisions, they hope to jiggle the molasses, flick off a little speck, and in that way detect the Higgs particle. And July 4th, of last year was the first announcement that there was now evidence that that little tiny speck of the Higgs field, that little tiny Higgs particle, had indeed been found.
You've talked about that the speck is just so – I mean, we can't see the speck. And you talk about how unstable it is. I guess it – I don't even know if this is the way to put it – dissipates in some ways pretty quickly. So you have to catch it with something pretty sophisticated. That's what these detectors are doing.
That's right. There are these absolutely mammoth detectors that are surrounding a thin little tunnel. So this thin little tunnel winds its way from Geneva across the French border and back. As you said, it's about 18 miles long. And in various locations along this thin tunnel, there are these gargantuan detectors that are able to catch all of the debris that these collisions create. All the particulate debris, the detritus, if you will, gets spit out and these detectors catch it. And that's vital because, as you're saying, the Higgs particle itself, our equations show, would disintegrate. Dissipate's a fine way of saying it. I like to think of it as disintegrating into a spray of other lighter particles. And it's almost like a CSI experiment. You capture those other particles in the mammoth detector, and then you work backwards to figure out what particle must have created that spray of debris. And if the mathematics is correct, it tells you what you should find in that spray of debris. If it was a Higgs particle as the culprit, and now people have seen just what you should see if the Higgs was the particle that disintegrated.
I love how you put it in a speech that you gave once where you said trying to find this signature, this speck, this droplet, was like trying to hear a whisper over the din of a NASCAR, like trying to hear a whisper over the din of a NASCAR race.
Yeah, that's right, because, you know, when you slam these protons together, the kinds of debris that they more usually create is not the Higgs particle. They create all sorts of other particles. A whole particle zoo is created in these very messy collisions. And within that maelstrom of particles, you're looking for one particular particle that is produced just every so often, and you're looking for its disintegration, the debris from its disintegration. And it is a huge challenge that the teams of physicists that number into the thousands are up against, and they've written computer codes, millions of lines of computer code, to very, very rapidly sift through the data from these collisions, because these collisions are happening many, many, many times per second, and look for that one or two or three examples of the byproducts that the math says should be there if a Higgs was every so often produced.
Some people have called it the God particle. Most scientists, it seems, aren't crazy about that term.
Yeah, we don't really like that. In fact, the story of it is a little bit more involved. The Nobel laureate Leon Lederman, who is a great physicist, a very funny man, he wrote a book about the Higgs particle. And the Higgs has been elusive. It's been very hard to find. So he thought a catchy title for the book might be the Goddamn Particle. Goddamn, it's so hard to find this particle.
Right.
And the publishers, I don't know, they didn't really warm to that title and somehow convinced him to drop the second part of it and just call it the God particle, which the reason why we typically recoil against that name is there is an interesting place in the sociology of these ideas for where religion and where God comes into the story. And that's an interesting conversation that we could have, perhaps different from the one we're having now.
Yeah.
But the Higgs particle itself really has nothing to do with that conversation in any deep, fundamental, interesting way. Therefore, the name is so misleading, and we like to stay away from it.
Mm. So let's talk about why this is so important. We'll get to why it should be important to all of us. Let's talk about why it's important to physicists like you. And I guess we have to back up again, back to the 1960s, to this idea that was emerging, as you've written about, this idea of symmetry. The data was sort of – scientists were seeing this data falling into these patterns that represented a kind of symmetry, a kind of unified whole. Explain that, if you would.
Yes. So back in the 1950s and 60s, as we began to probe the microscopic realm, the realm of atoms and the subatomic particles that make them up, there was at first a huge confusion because a huge number of different particle species were being found in these experiments. And there was no order. There was no rhyme or reason to what was being found. And we physicists, we hunger for, we look for patterns in the data.
Right.
And after a while, some very insightful physicists began to see the patterns in that data, which was quite wonderful. All the particles were now in some metaphorical way arranging themselves like the dots on the edge of a very symmetric snowflake. So it was all exactly as this very beautiful geometric approach to physics was suggesting the particles should arrange themselves. But as people studied those mathematical incarnations of the data in detail, they came upon the problem that we mentioned before. The symmetry itself seemed to forbid particles from having mass. Mm. So people were kind of tearing their hair out of their heads, had this very beautiful mathematical structure, all these wondrous symmetries that were aligning with the data, with the one problem being the symmetry itself was in direct conflict with the observation that the particles had mass. Mm. And that's where Peter Higgs really entered the story, because he found that you could have your cake and eat it too.
Right.
You could have equations that were highly, highly symmetric that seemed to not allow particles to have mass by virtue of injecting mass from a different source, not from the equations and the symmetry per se, but from the environment. He said you're not taking account of the environment. If the environment is filled with this Higgs molasses that we were mentioning before, then those very symmetric equations in that environment do allow particles to have mass. So all of a sudden, mathematically, we could have it all. And that was very, very exciting, with the one question being, is it true?
Right.
Is it right?
So what's crucial about the Higgs particle, it seems, is that, as you've explained it, it's a new kind of matter. It's the only particle – I'm going to really oversimplify this, Dr. Green, so you can help me make more sense of it. But it's the only particle that we know of, as I understand it, that doesn't spin.
Yes. That's a fine way of saying it. We have discovered way back in the early part of the 20th century that all of the fundamental particles do have – a quantum characteristic that we call spin. It's not exactly like the spin of a top, but that's a fine way of thinking about it.
Right.
And what we have found is that the particles that are very familiar to us, the electrons and quarks that make up the atoms, that make up everything that we see in the world around us, they all spin at the same rate. In the units that we use, we say that they spin at the rate of 1/2. The number doesn't really matter, but it's just an intrinsic characteristic that the particles all spin around. The difference with the Higgs is, as you're saying, the math said for this Higgs idea to work, the Higgs particle can't spin at all. The Higgs particle has to be a spinless particle, and we don't have any fundamental particles with that characteristic. And the discovery of the Higgs, therefore, is the very first example of, in some sense, this new form of matter, matter that at its particulate level does not spin around.
And why that's a big deal, this Higgs particle then, is because you talked about how it gives us a new way of looking at, I mean, the biggest of questions, the cosmological questions, like how it is possible for the Big Bang to have happened.
Right. I mean, the link to the Big Bang is a subtle and interesting one, because after people like Higgs put forward this idea of particles that don't spin around, people found applications for that idea, that spinless particle idea, outside of the context in which Higgs originally put it forward. Mm. And one of the big applications of that idea, it turns out, is at the other end of the spectrum. We're talking mostly about little tiny particles at the heart of matter. But people who work on cosmology, trying to understand the biggest view of the universe, where the universe itself came from, the Big Bang and so on, found that the spinless particles could have a profound role there. And in a nutshell, the idea is that these spinless particles, we can call them spinless fields, if you will, they can easily give rise to a repulsive form of gravity. And that repulsive form of gravity, the proposal goes, may be what pushed everything apart at the very beginning. So the bang in the Big Bang may have been the repulsive gravitational push coming from a class of particles that are close cousins of the Higgs particle.
I wonder, so the discovery may have confirmed something that the theories have been predicting then. So it was expected. You know, that this, you know, you were pretty confident, I'm guessing. A lot of others probably were. And now it's confirmed it. And I guess the question comes up, were you let down by that in some way? I mean, you know, I guess you were thrilled and you were delighted, but now you know this thing that you've been theorizing about for so many years. Does that make sense?
No, you're right. I mean, it definitely cuts both ways because on the one hand, it is thrilling to have another concrete example where mathematical calculations which come out of our brains, our heads, this gray blob inside our head, we do these mathematical calculations on a piece of paper, and to find that those calculations align with what's happening in the real world is the most thrilling thing you can imagine, whether you're a physicist or not. I mean, honestly, when I was in high school, I remember being set my first physics problem, and it was some silly thing about a ball being stuck to a piece of chewing gum that you're swinging around, and you're asked to figure out how the ball will move, and I did the calculation. And when I was done, I ran down the hall to my dad because it was such an exciting moment. There I was at my desk doing a calculation, and the result would tell me something that would happen in the real world. Mm-hmm. So the Higgs has just taken that very experience to the umpteenth degree, and that's where the excitement comes from. At the same time, though, it does close a door. It shows us that what we were thinking was correct, that chapter of discovery is perhaps closed, and there are many things that can happen beyond it. Mm-hmm. But it would, at some level, have been more exciting for us to have come upon something unexpected, something that really rocked our world, something that sent all the physicists scurrying back to their blackboards to say, holy cow, what we thought was true for all these years, it's not correct. Let's get back there and figure out what's really going on. And that's a great opportunity for physicists and one that a discovery of this sort doesn't allow to have happen. Mm. So it does cut both ways. But I suspect if you're Peter Higgs, you're pretty happy that, right, that the particle was found.
He was in tears.
Yeah, that was a very moving thing. Yeah. That's right. At the July 4th conference, I was watching it from Aspen, Colorado. It was about 2 o'clock in the morning because it was being announced over in another side of the world, in Geneva. And when the data was finally shown, convincing everyone that this Higgs particle had been found, he did choke up. And you can well imagine, you know, he's been sitting around, I mean, doing other things, but his big life's discovery hanging out there, I guess he must have wondered whether it would be confirmed or disproved in his own lifetime. And there he was at the announcement. And they were saying, what you thought of 45 years ago that everybody thought you were nuts about at first, it's true. Wow. What vindication.
Brian Greene is with us, professor of physics and mathematics at Columbia University. His most recent book is The Hidden Reality, Parallel Universes and the Deep Laws of the Cosmos. We need to take a brief break. When we get back, we'll talk about what happens next. What now? You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back in March, research teams at the Large Hadron Collider in Switzerland announced that they had confirmed the existence of this elementary particle, a particle that is critical to our understanding of the universe. It's known as the Higgs boson. It was a big deal for science. And today in the program, we have with us Dr. Brian Greene to help us explain why this is such a big deal. He's a professor of physics and mathematics at Columbia University, the author of a number of books, among them his latest, The Hidden Reality, Parallel Universes and the Deep Laws of the Cosmos. So, Brian Greene, I wanted to ask you about if the main motivation for building this massive collider was to was to find the Higgs, and now we think we found it. What do you do with this big machine?
Well, there's still a lot of work to be done, even associated with the Higgs. Yeah. So the idea of a Higgs particle is a very broad and all-encompassing one in which there are the possibility of realizations that differ in detail. And what we're doing now is analyzing the data and in a couple of years turning the machine back on to take even more data to nail down all the details so that we know the precise values of the particle's mass. We know the precise way in which it talks to other particles, its interactions, and so forth. So one thing will be really building that full understanding of the Higgs that we believe we found. But there are a huge number of other puzzles that are not Higgs related that the Large Hadron Collider can also investigate. And we can talk about those. Bottom line is there are many, many great ideas on the table that the Large Hadron Collider has a capacity to test.
Mm. I want to talk about some of the things that you've been interested in, extraspatial dimensions and supersymmetry. But let's take a call from a listener. 801-585-WEST is the number. John is with us in Salt Lake. John, welcome.
Yeah. The question I have is one of scale relating this to human being. In all the pictures I've seen of the collisions, I've never heard anyone say what size these collisions are. Are they a hundredth of an inch, 12 feet? And the same question of scale on the detector. Why must the detector be four stories high?
Right. So the particles that we're talking about are subatomic particles. So perhaps a good number to keep in mind is the scale of atoms. Atoms are roughly in the scale of 10 to the, say, minus 10 meters. The nucleus is on the order of 10 to the minus 15 meters. And the Large Hadron Collider itself can probe down to something like, I don't know, 10 to the minus 18, 10 to the minus 19 meters, something of that sort. So those are the scales that we are talking about, very, very far removed from anything in everyday life. Now, the reason why the detectors need to be so massive, so voluminous, is that there are a huge number of different species of particles that get produced in the collisions. And in some sense, the detector is layered, where each layer is fine-tuned, constructed to be the best way of capturing a particular kind of particle. So when you want to capture this huge number of particles of a variety of different species, you need to layer together a lot of different components. And when the dust settles, the folks who are ingenious at building these detectors create what really can be viewed as the most precise, the most complex, the most massive of technological detectors that really have ever been built.
For a good part of your career, Brian Greene, you focused on the possibility that the three dimensions of space may not be the only ones. In your book, The Hidden Reality, we had you on, and you were talking about how there were various ways in which the universe could be just one of many, not nine ways you explore in the book. And I wonder, is the this discovery, is it providing you new insights on that kind of thinking?
Well, I think there are two ways of answering that question, both relevant. The first is the very fact that the Higgs particle has been confirmed confirms the approach, the mathematical approach that we have been following really since the time of Newton, that even in domains where we have not yet been able to probe observationally or experimentally, mathematics can be trusted as at least a sure-footed guide to what might be happening there. And it's mathematics that has led us to the possibility of more dimensions than the three that we all know about, left, right, back, forth, and up, down. Mm-hmm. And therefore, when you see mathematics being confirmed again through the Higgs idea, it gives you confidence that you're using the right kind of tool to analyze how reality is constructed. Now, that's sort of an abstract answer. A more concrete one is, in principle, the Large Hadron Collider could find evidence for the extra dimensions.
Yeah.
The idea is quite straightforward. When you slam these protons together, as we're talking about, and you create the spray of debris, if there are extra dimensions of space, then the equations suggest that some of the debris from the collisions can leave our dimensions and enter the other dimensions. And how would we know that? Well, if you have some debris leaving our dimensions, that debris will take away some energy that will elude our detectors in these dimensions, which means if you compare the amount of energy that we measure after the collision to the amount of energy we had before the collision, we should have a little less after than before if some of it has disappeared to the other dimensions. So people are looking for those missing energy signatures in the hope that if we're lucky, we might find evidence of the extra dimensions that our equations are suggesting.
Do you have any sense of how far away we might be from a revelation like that or a discovery like that?
I mean, that's a very hard question to answer. We don't have crystal balls, of course, when it comes to these ideas. And even a little bit more specifically, there are no real clues in our equations as to what size the extra dimensions would be. The other caller asked about scale. That's the one that's relevant here too. The conventional way of thinking about the extra dimensions put their size at about 10 to the minus 35 meters.
Wow.
I mean, that's orders of magnitude smaller than even the subatomic scales we were talking about in answer to that question. But the math also seems to allow the dimensions to be somewhat bigger, not macroscopically bigger, but perhaps not that much smaller than the subatomic scales we were talking about before. But still, that's a huge range of possibilities. And if the dimensions are too small, there's no way that the Large Hadron Collider will ever be able to detect them. But if we're lucky and the extra dimensions are small but not that small, there is a chance that the data could reveal something, say, within the next handful of years.
Mm. You've talked about how you're hoping all of this will reveal the evidence of what you call supersymmetry, this idea that every known particle has what you've called a partner particle. Because you've talked about how if this partner particle concept, or sparticles, I think is how you talked about it. If they were to be found, you've written this, you said that nature would prove almost unreasonably mathematical in its construction.
That's right. So we were talking about how in the 60s people were putting the data into these wondrous patterns that reflected deep symmetries within the laws of nature. Well, it turned out that in the 70s and 80s, mathematically oriented physicists found a surprising new symmetry within the mathematics that nature seemed not yet to have made use of, or at least if it made use of it, we hadn't seen the evidence for it. And being very symmetric-minded in our approach to the way the world is constructed, teams of physicists, including me, have spent a very long time analyzing these super-symmetric equations, the super meaning it's yet more symmetric than anything that we found before, and concluded that if these ideas are correct, for every known particle, there should be the partner particle that you are referring to. For the electron, there should be a supersymmetric cousin of the electron that we call the selectron. For quarks, there should be squarks. For neutrinos, there should be sneutrinos. So these sparticles that the mathematics suggests should be that we've not seen evidence for, but one of the other reasons for building the Large Hadron Collider is the hope that in these powerful collisions, these sparticles will be found. We have not found them yet. Some people are getting pretty uncomfortable by the data having not yet turned up these particles. But really, nature will speak for herself, and we'll find out in the next few years whether this supersymmetric quality that's in the equations is realized in nature.
You've talked about how there is there's a chance of producing microscopic black holes that might show some evidence of certain things. Do we have time for you to explain that, or is that really
complicated? Sure. I mean, it's a pretty simple idea. Most people think about black holes as these big gargantuan things out there in the cosmos that if matter gets too close, matter falls in and it can't escape. But in actuality, the mathematics allows black holes even to be small, microscopic. If you cram enough matter into a small enough space, even if it's microscopic in size, it can become a black hole. And the equations of string theory allow for that possibility. Now, the funny thing is, well, perhaps not that funny, when this idea of producing a microscopic black hole became known to the public back in 2008, some people got a little agitated. There was anxiety. You know, if we produce a little black hole in Geneva, what would that mean? Would it suck in its surroundings? Would, like, Geneva get pulled into the black hole? And I don't know, when it was focused on Europe, America didn't really care that much. But then, you know, if Geneva gets sucked in, perhaps the rest of the world will get sucked in too. So, you know, restraining orders were put out to stop the collider from turning on for fear that these little microscopic black holes would be created. It wasn't a crazy concern, but physicists had sat down and done the calculations, and these little microscopic black holes, like the Higgs particle, would disintegrate in a tiny fraction of a second. There's really no concern whatsoever. Instead, it would be a fantastic thing. Imagine if we could create little black holes in the laboratory and study them as they fall apart into a spray of other particles. That would be a spectacular moment for physics. We haven't seen evidence for it yet at the Large Hadron Collider, but that would be one of the most spectacular discoveries if in the next few years we actually find that we can produce tiny black holes in the laboratory.
Wow. You know, you have you talked about how we with the discovery of quantum mechanics at the around the 20s of the last century. You know, at first it seemed really complicated, really abstract and complicated. But now we've translated that idea into very practical things. And we have intricate circuits. It gives us cell phones and computers. All of that's translated into tangible stuff. So how do you think, or is it maybe too early to suggest how this discovery could in some way translate into something more tangible, if that makes sense?
I mean, it's a good question. It's a hard one to answer. And I guess I'll fall back on the fact that if you had Erwin Schrödinger or Einstein or Niels Bohr on your show back in the 1920s and asked them, okay, you guys are working out this quantum mechanics. What's it going to be good for? My guess is that they probably would have said, I don't know. You know, we're trying to understand atoms and particles, but that's pretty far removed from everyday life. But then as you've already indicated, you know, 80 years later, the understanding from quantum mechanics allows us to manipulate the microscopic realm in powerful ways, creating integrated circuits that you mentioned and all of the things that flow from that, from cell phones to personal computers to medical technology that saves lives around the world every second. So it's just to say, when you're working on the fundamental ideas, it's very hard to predict where that understanding will go. But the pattern of progress certainly is you understand things well, and once you understand them, you can begin to use them to manipulate the environment in powerful ways. And so who knows where these ideas will go, you know, if they're correct in 50, 80, 100, 500 years. I wish I would be around to see it because I suspect it's going to be very exciting, but it's hard to speculate as to what the details will be.
Yeah. You know, I was reading an article about the confirmation of the Higgs particle in The Economist. And the writer put it this way, that humans had, as he put it, once again peeled another layer from the surface of reality, which brought me back to what you had written in your book, The Hidden Reality, because you said that it's going to require of us a new paradigm shift in the way we think, new possibilities of the way we think about reality. And you talked about how difficult it will be to imagine, but I wonder what you think, how this is going to change us, our perceptions of reality. Have you thought about that?
Well, I think the Higgs discovery itself, in that it already fits into the paradigm that we've been using for many decades, yeah, is not going to require that kind of a radical rethinking. But the other ideas that are on the table, the ones that we've also spoken about with supersymmetry and producing microscopic black holes and other ideas that we haven't had time to speak about, unified theories and string theory. We mentioned a little bit about extra dimensions. As this collection of ideas swirls around, if the data should show that any of these ideas are correct, then we will be propelled into a new era where the very nature of reality will be back on the table as we try to find the vocabulary, the mathematics, the fundamental ideas that are most aligned with the new insights coming from observation. I mean, every age has to go through that kind of transformation where there are new breakthroughs, new understanding. And as that occurs, the mindset has to shift too. No doubt that will be the case going forward, whether the ideas that we're talking about here today will be the ones that will be the currency of future understanding, I don't know. But I have little doubt that there are a huge number of surprises that are right around the corner. Whether the math has already anticipated them or not, I don't know.
You know, it made me wonder also about whether or not the Hadron Collider is going to be big enough to test some of these ideas. You yourself have written about a linear collider, maybe the next step in the process. You also wrote in Hidden Realities about what you called a heavy ion collider, a relativistic heavy ion collider, I think is how you put it, which may give us some sense about, I don't know, I loved this idea in the book, this holographic projection of another universe, a parallel process taking place.
Yeah, I wish we had time to talk more about that, because that could well be the new language for describing reality going forward. But speaking more generally, I would say that there's a real chance that the Large Hadron Collider is not powerful enough to give us insight into many of these ideas, which is from a strategic, sociological, government policy perspective a little bit frightening, because if the only thing that the Large Hadron Collider reveals after all this money and all this work, if all it reveals is something that we thought to be true already, yeah, we've discussed, that's hugely exciting. But imagine, you know, going back to a funding agency to say, okay, we spent billions of dollars, we found exactly what we were looking for, we've not found any evidence or anything else, so give us more money to build the next machine. It's somehow not as compelling as going back to say, hey, we've confirmed what we thought. We now have hints of a spectacular new realm from unexpected data. We need money to explore that. If we can't make that latter claim, it will take some very insightful, far-sighted politicians to recognize the value of building that next machine, even though we don't know what we'll find and we don't have any evidence that there's anything interesting to be found there. So hopefully we won't find ourselves in that situation, but you can imagine that we may not have the political will to go the next step, to keep pushing the envelope of exploration and discovery. I hope we do, and I'll do all I can to keep the interest and excitement going on that front, but we really need, ideally, some spectacular, unexpected piece of data to emerge from the Large Hadron Collider.
That's Dr. Brian Green, professor of physics and mathematics at Columbia University, author of a number of books on the inner workings of the universe. His latest is called The Hidden Reality, Parallel Universes and the Deep Laws of the Cosmos. Joined us from the Radio Foundation in New York City. Dr. Green, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, technical direction from Mike Anderson, our theme music composed by The Moth and the Flame. Our thanks to Taylor Almond and Susan Anderson. The program is produced by Lane Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.